citizens of New York. Perceptions of the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. The world's mightiest fortress.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of mere earth.
In the sky, it's a bird, it's a plane, no, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it, Kick-Ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is what the hell I'm doing here.
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
Oh, don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess it didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
They get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Big Hero 6, released November 7th, 2014, budget of $165 million, box office $657.8 million. This was directed by the tandem of Don Hall and Chris Williams. Well, we're back to Marvel proper, but not in the way that a lot of people recognize, because when you talk about Disney acquiring Marvel, this is left out because it's not part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but it nevertheless has its roots in Marvel Comics, like everything we're reviewing. So, Garrett, when this came out, did you have any idea that this was tied into comic books whatsoever?
Absolutely not. It was only after it was out a while, and some of the sites I was a part of were talking about that, and I literally had no idea. However, that did pique my interest, and look, I'm not like you guys. I don't have kids. I don't have any real reason to see an animated film. At this point, my brother was pretty grown. I couldn't take him to see it. I went, and I actually just rented it myself, and I watched it myself, just off the sheer fact that it was based off of something that maybe it would tie into something. Spoiler alert, it doesn't. But I'm going to need your help in telling me the actual origins of this, because I have no idea. You know, when we did Transformers 1, we mentioned that was kind of based off some original ideas they had for Generation 1. This, I had no idea about it even tying into comics whatsoever until it was out probably 3-4 months.
Adam, what about you?
I knew about it, but only because of some of the comic circles that I chat in and talk to and things like that. It wasn't something that I had read. It wasn't something that I was extremely abreast of, but I knew of it. I knew it existed. Kind of like Guardians of the Galaxy. I knew there was a comic, even if it wasn't a comic I was familiar with. However, I'll say the comic, much like so much of the MCU, just because it takes a name doesn't mean it really corresponds with what that name means.
Well, plus this doesn't have a flipping comic logo attached to it. It feels so detached from Marvel. again, I just need to know what is the association there, because the advertising and the actual movie itself doesn't display itself as being a comic book movie.
No, you know when Marvel decided it was part of Marvel? When the thing grossed close to 300 to three quarters of $1 billion. Mm. That's when Marvel was like, oh yeah, it's part of us.
All right. Well, much like Adam, I have never read any of the Big Hero 6 comics, but in doing some digging, I learned that two of the main characters from Big Hero 6 in the comics are X-Men characters. Mm-hmm. Silver Samurai and Sunfire.
Hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, they were supposed to be part of Alpha Flight originally, which ties into X-Men.
Specifically tied into Wolverine.
Yeah, so it goes back to late 90s.
Yeah, because this started in, I want to say, 98, 99?
Yeah, I think 98, late 98.
Yeah, because they eventually showed up in Alpha Flight. But that was years after they were originally supposed to be. But they're basically a superhuman conglomerate that works for the Japanese government, to my understanding. I don't know what else to compare it to. That's kind of like the Justice League, where it's a revolving lineup. And I do know that they've met characters like Spider-Man, of course, having two characters closely tied to X-Men with Silver Samurai and Sunfire. But I could see why, getting into the development history, let's remember, this was developed at the time where X-Men was still held by Fox, which probably explains why neither of those characters are in this movie.
Okay, so it also ran into the problem that most Fox movies around this time ran into, where there's some characters they could use and some characters they couldn't. I wouldn't have known that was...
Now, I don't know if that's a definitive truth, but that would certainly be, if you were asking me to come up with a theory, that would make the most sense, especially because Silver Samurai was quote-unquote done in the Wolverine the year before.
Yeah, and you see Sunfire. Is it Sunfire that's in...
A Sunspot.
Sunspot in Days of Future Past. I think Sunfire's on the Fox TV series that they did.
Was it The Gifted?
Yep, that's it.
So, you know, it is a Marvel property, but it's not what people think of, which is why I think this didn't, to Adam's point, it didn't get the cross-branding until it made as much money as it did, which is not surprising because, let's remember, also, this is part of Disney's animated lineup. From Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs all the way up to now, this is part of their history. And it came out at a time, so let's talk about the history, where Disney was at this time, Disney Animation, because they had already bought Marvel, Star Wars was in development, but Disney Animation was... After 1999, when the Renaissance basically died with Tarzan, they were throwing shit at the wall. You had movies like Emperor's New Groove, which were very slapsticky, kind of more Warner Brothers-esque. But then they put out garbage like Chicken Little and Home on the Range, where I feel like the early animators would be rolling in their graves if they saw what Disney became. But in 2009, they put out The Princess and the Frog, which was really a return to form, not just for like fairy tale storytelling, which is what Disney made their name on, but it was 2D, it was hand-drawn 2D animation, which had kind of gone away.
Yeah.
Now, it didn't last long, because the year after they made Tangled, which was 3D.
Yes.
And this came out the year after Frozen ironically set the world on fire and made every parent want to drive into oncoming traffic when Idina Menzel came on the radio.
Yeah, my love, Frozen.
I saw it once, and I have not gone back to it. And this was the movie that followed Frozen. This was their next one up. So when Disney acquired Marvel, Adam's favorite, Bob Iger, encouraged them to explore Marvel properties for quote-unquote adaptation concepts, which is code for pick stuff we can make money off.
Yeah.
But by picking an obscure title, which this is, like, this is even more obscure than Guardians of the Galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because you would say that, while not well-known, ironically, this came out the same year Guardians did, but that had a very devoted, albeit small, niched fan base. This...
And had been rebooted a few times.
Yeah, the version people think of with Rocket Raccoon and all that is not the original lineup. And they brought in directors. You know, Don Hall directed the 2011 Winnie the Pooh, which is really good. But really good. You wouldn't think that it would translate to this type of movie, because much like Wreck-It Ralph, this feels like a movie that Pixar made, not necessarily Disney.
Yes, and this does feel when there almost seems to be, you know, when you look at financial lines and graphs and that point where you kind of cross and what was up is down, what was down and up, it seems like this is right around that time where Pixar and Disney Animation Studios crossed back over and just that quality came back to Disney was around these years.
Yeah, Pixar, though, not so much, because while Disney made Wreck-It Ralph, Pixar made Brave, which should have been called Bitch. Because, I hate the main character in that movie so much.
I love Brave.
But that felt much more like a Disney movie, and Wreck-It Ralph felt so much more like a Pixar movie.
Yeah.
This, I feel like, has a similar thing. Part of it is just because you can't escape the thought of The Incredibles.
No, especially with an animated teen movie. You have to think Incredibles.
And the director pitched this concept to, I feel like every time I say this name now, I cringe, John Lasseter, for ideas with Disney Animation. And everybody loved it. And this thing went into production. They only read a few issues of the comic, which is fine. I mean, that's more work than Tim Burton did.
When he was gotta take Kevin a dig.
He ever does.
Every single fucking time. God, you guys. Reignited himself with Beetlejuice 2. Leave him alone.
Well, I feel like he just took himself off life support, and now he's on painkillers. He's on blood pressure medication now, where it can spike at any moment. But they brought in Marvel's creative team, including Jeff Loeb, who I can't stand.
Why?
Okay, Jeff Loeb is the master of making himself... Him and Jim Lee, Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale made a career out of just refurbishing shit that other people have done better. Like, there was a period in the 2000s where they just did Origins again and added colors. Like, they did Spider-Man Blue, Daredevil Yellow, Captain America White. Most of them sucked. And everyone's like, how could you hate The Long Halloween? I'm like, I don't hate it. I just think it's, if you know nothing about Batman, it's a good place to start. But if you know Batman in any capacity, I don't think you're going to get much out of it. And a lot of the other stuff he's written, I really not cared for.
Okay.
Which includes some of his writing on TV shows like Lost and Smallville.
Smallville, yeah.
Ugh. Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Ugh. Now, I do love Commando, but he's not the sole writer on that. And look, that movie's not going to win an Oscar for writing. And they also brought in my other favorite person, Joe Quesada, who is the brain dead dipshit who said, oh yeah, Spider-Man's marriage? Oh, that never happened. And then kept having to do these mental gymnastics to explain himself after the Brand New Day fiasco.
Okay, I was just curious because I've heard nothing but praise for Jeff Loeb by comic book fans. And so I've never heard somebody rail on him, but okay.
I'm going to say I did think as an executive, I thought he was going to take over DC when it redid instead of James Gunn.
Ugh, I would have preferred it.
He is entrenched in kind of the behind the scenes now with a lot of comic adaptations.
Hmm.
He's kind of the go-to. I mean, but he also did, was it the Howie Long Fire?
Oh, wow. Firestorm? What the hell?
Yeah, Firestorm.
Yes, he wrote that.
And did
that
he really?
Yep.
Adam, you and I saw that. Hit. We rented it one time from when I was working at Hollywood Video. Oh my God.
There's a brilliant podcast of him, and I think it's on early Kevin Smith, where he talks about, I just walked in, was given all these scripts, and then Titanic decided that it was going to move our major release to a one theater, and I couldn't get jobs for years because movie lost so much money.
And I have two words also to support my argument against Jeff Loeb. Two words, Ultimates 3.
I don't even know what that is.
Can't stand Ultimates, all those. That's why I'm not reading any of the Absolutes right now. I just, it's desperation.
Yeah, and also Jeff Loeb has been involved in varying degrees with some good stuff with Marvel Television, and also some of the worst stuff they've ever done, like Inhumans and Iron Fist.
Oh my God.
So, yeah, I'm not going to call Jeff Loeb a hack. He's like a half step above that, because he's written a couple of things that I do appreciate. But anyway, time to get off my soapbox, because I don't get to talk about comics that much, although these shows will give me the opportunity to do so. I just had to get that out there, because that's been burning at me, the way Batman 89... having the Joker killing Batman's parents pissed off Adam so much, he just got it out there. I had to do the same thing, but they brought in this team, and Marvel did not want to do a tie-in comic. Instead, Disney said, we'll just reprint the Marvel version. Marvel disagreed, and I guess Disney won the power struggle.
Which was ridiculous, because at this time, every MCU movie that was coming out, they would put out like a two-issue comic tie-in of like, hey, here's the 10 minutes before the movie starts. And you know what? Some of them are fun. They're little add-ons. They're a way to kind of spike you and get you excited. And that they failed to do it on something, especially when you want... I mean, come on, use the cigarette motto. Get kids addicted early. That's what they should be doing. And Disney, I don't know how the fuck Disney, who owns Marvel, keeps dropping the ball with comics to kids, but they sure do.
Yeah, and to your point, they were taking the names and iconography from the comics and doing their own thing. Like Civil War is nothing like the comic. Winter Soldier is nothing like the comic. They took Extremis elements in Iron Man 3 and just did their own thing. So they were really not, I don't want to say being disrespectful to the comics, but they were also not being as faithful as they claimed to be.
Get ready for Secret Wars, everybody. Secret Invasion, anyone?
Yeah, well, it's funny. I mean, look, this came out the same year as Winter Soldier and Guardians of the Galaxy, so Marvel was riding a pretty good high as far as audience and critical unison. Everyone was united, which makes me wonder, why did you not then advertise this as quote-unquote Marvel?
Yeah, that's my point, is they were taking obscure characters like Iron Man and turning them into huge box office draws. Of course, that had to do a lot with the star, which we'll talk about in at least 5 years, but I have no idea why they would not attach the Marvel logo, unless Marvel was trying to detach itself from this, which was my original question. Why is it that we did not know until weeks after it was out, at least me, the non-comic book fan, non-modern comic book fan, why I didn't know until weeks later that this was actually a Marvel property?
Yeah, it's... I feel like it was a missed opportunity because maybe if they advertise a little bit more, I mean, look, $650 million is nothing to scoff at, but
yeah, that's maybe a lot of money.
This could have done better. And it did spawn a TV show that ran for 2017 to 2021.
Wow. Yep. And then they did two different ones. They had a short, and then they had another one that was Baymax! Exclamation point.
Who was a character that was drastically altered compared to how he's depicted in the comic. But look, that's nothing new for Marvel because two words, Hugh Jackman. The precedent has been there.
Hugh Jackman.
Yeah, to do other stuff. And, you know, you look at this voice cast, they didn't really go after huge names, quote unquote. There wasn't much to advertise beyond some pretty clever marketing. I mean, they put Baymax front and center, and I do think in a lot of ways he sold the movie, especially that initial teaser trailer with putting the armor on.
Well, they took the E.T. approach, right? A little boy and his alien.
I was thinking Iron Giant, boy and his robot.
Well, that too. Yeah, I guess you could call that clever. But again, the fact that this was advertised as a non-Marvel film and it still made as much money as it did just goes to the power of the mouse house, right? But it wouldn't have drawn somebody who was like a huge comic book geek in because they had no idea that it was actually attached to a comic book property.
And it came out, I went to go see it in the theater. I didn't have kids at that time, but with Disney Animation, I see everything they do in theaters, even though sometimes I regret it. Wish being a prime example of things. I wish I could get my time back and my money for that matter.
Wish. God, I forgot about that one.
Yeah, and it bombed. So I guess Disney, quote unquote, wishes they could have done things very differently. But this did well. I mean, look, 10 years later, there is still a certain group. It's kind of like The Incredibles, where people are kind of demanding a sequel.
Really?
And even more so, Disney California Adventure, so the theme park side-by-side with Disneyland. Sorry, Matt, if I step on your toes here. But they just completely refurbished an area to be San Francisco from this film.
Really?
So they've made a lot of California Adventure into Pixar. They got Pixar Pier. They've done a lot of that. But they took an entire waterfront area, which used to be San Francisco. You literally had, or you still have a Ghirardelli Chocolate Factory. You used to have Mission Tortillas. You have Bodan Bakery. It's a food area, but it is now San Francisco. And as somebody who was there last year, and I was rolling my eyes when they were doing it, I was walking through it with my kids, who now are 10 years older from this movie. They were digging it. And the families in the area were like, this is cool. And walking across the refurbished Golden Gate Bridge, it's pretty fucking cool, I gotta say. But with them not doing much lately, I can't believe they found a way that they repurposed part of a park to put this in, because that's not cheap.
No, and it's surprising because, I mean, they're doing something similar in Florida where they're taking the Muppet section and that's becoming Monster or Monstropolis.
Yeah.
Yep. That movie's 25 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is 10 plus, but also you got to remember, hate to say this, but Disney has been bowing down to their Asian masters for 10 plus years at this point. So,
but that's been Hollywood in general, though. Matt, we talked about that when we did Transformers those years ago, where they were showing those in Asia way before America even got a hold of them. So they've been really bowing down to that for a set of years. They were probably one of the first to actually do it, and then other studios followed suit.
Well, speaking of following suit, let's get into the movie, because we surprisingly have a decent amount to cover for something that's only...
Yeah, I was surprised at how complex this plot was.
Well, complex is relative. Let's get into it.
Okay.
So we open up. This movie does take place in the quote-unquote real world, but it's a futuristic city called San Francisco. Try saying that after a few beers. I think the filmmakers really paid attention to the architecture from Blade Runner.
I got some Blade Runner from it. I thought it was pretty creative the way they handled this, you know. And Adam, you said a lot of what's here is reinterpreted. When you watch this movie, does it really ring true that a lot of this is similar to that?
In the theme park?
Yeah.
As much as they can. There's no buildings or anything in that area, so it's more the bridge and the color palettes that they use and things like that. But it does definitely get that feel. It gets it pretty strong.
Yeah, and also there's a big Miyazaki influence with a lot of the
huge
design work too. I mean, look, Baymax might as well be Totoro 2.0.
Yep.
In a lot of ways, which we'll talk about shortly. And by the way, everything I just said, that's not a negative, because if you're gonna pay homage to somebody in animation, Miyazaki's not a bad one to do.
Yeah,
good from the best.
And we're introduced to our main character, Hero, which I will give the movie credit. The title is not Big Hero 6, as in H-I-R-O, which is how the main character's name is spelled. Which would have been too much for me.
What do you mean too much? I mean, that's the MO, right? That's the way.
Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't do that.
Okay, but when you say it would have been too much what? That would have been just too much winking at you? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, too much inside baseball.
Gotcha.
Which Hero is not, he's not an athlete, speaking of baseball. He's involved in the dangerous world of illegal robot fighting. So it's basically Rock'em Sock'em Robots mixed with Fight Club.
Yeah, 3 years before this, there was Real Steel with Hugh Jackman, and I got that feeling while watching this. I'm seeing a sequel to Real Steel.
Hopefully one day.
That movie's trash. Call me a raccoon, because I genuinely like that movie.
Oh, my God.
Same here.
Oh, you guys are out of your minds.
I genuinely like that movie. But, you know, Hero is your prototypical boy genius in a lot of ways, where he's building these little robots. He's not. I will appreciate the movie doesn't start with them using like transformers. They're almost like go karts or like the robots you'd assemble yourself. Just the technology is a little bit more updated because they can operate on their own. So I like that the world is futuristic, but it's not so far into science fiction that it feels outlandish.
Yeah, it feels like it's just half a step this way. Like, it feels like an alternate universe, not a completely rewritten reality.
It reminds me of how like the first Iron Man. Where I'm like, okay, there's some outlandish stuff, but nothing feels like implausible, so to speak. Everything operates within the internal logic of the movie as it's depicted. So there's nothing here that I really like rebel against.
Which is weird because, yes, Disney had acquired Marvel a lot of years before this. But in watching this, I was wondering, how are they going to interpret a comic in a Disney style? Whereas in Marvel, you're interpreting a comic, but you don't have to put too much of the Mouse House in it. It's only what they say they want in the actual film, which we'll talk about when we get to Marvel proper. Here, we're seeing a comic book plot done in a Disney style. And I really was wondering how are they going to handle this. But you know what? It's got a real, as I mentioned, a boy and his dog quality. And I like the way we're being introduced to these characters. This kid isn't just some kid who just falls into what happens to him. He's pretty smart. He's joining these robot fighting tournaments, and he really, really wants to make something of himself. And I think that's a really good story to tell to somebody who was Adam's kid's age when he took them to see this. I really liked getting to know these characters.
Well, he's also rebellious teenager, without being annoying, which is a hard thing to do.
Very. Go back to last week.
But also, he's kind of he's Peter Parker with a little more gray area, where like he's, I don't want to say skipping school, but like this is illegal, he's breaking the law. So he's got a bit of an edge. You know, he's not a Boy Scout, so he's voiced by kid who played Beast Boy on Titans.
All these people have tons of comic book origins.
Oh, just wait.
So, fight goes well, he goes home, and much like Marvel, both parents are out of the picture, so it's him, his older brother, Tadashi, and his, is it aunt?
This is Aunt Cass.
Yeah, Aunt Cass, so Aunt May, Aunt Cass. And as soon as I saw the brother, I saw crows circling over his...
Oh, for sure.
Tadashi is dead. Yeah, there's no doubt.
I was like, oh, I know where this is going. But he's telling him, like, he gives it the speech Pike gave Kirk in the 09 Star Trek movie, where he's like, I dare you to do better, basically. So he takes him to the Institute of Technology. Hero meets the titular, five of the titular six. Honey Lemon, Go-Go, Wasabi, and just Fred. And Fred is basically if Shaggy from Scooby-Doo got accepted to MIT, but he's only there because he knows how to get weed. Because I'm like, one of these does not belong with everyone else.
But I like the different characters, though. I like the way, the only thing that these people have in common is that they're smart. Everybody has their own, has their different personalities, and I like that. Again, I like the way that we're being introduced to this character and the way he's kind of being forced to integrate with these other characters.
Well, I also like that it's diversity without feeling like mandated diversity.
Yes, yes, which Disney, a few years after this, would have a huge problem doing. Everything about the diversity later on felt forced. And you're absolutely right. This all, like you said, feels natural.
When I'm first getting the introduction, the first time I'm watching this movie, I'm like, I cannot believe they're getting away with calling these characters Wasabi and Go-Go and Honey Lemon. I'm just like, did they just walk into High Bar and, you know, get character names from the menu? But later on, and it's because of my ignorance, these are the comic book names to these characters, which is unbelievable. But, well, maybe not for 1998, but these are comic accurate, at least in the way of the names they pulled.
Wow, these go back to the late 90s, huh? This comic?
98, yep.
Wow.
Well, let's also not forget, Disney once had a character named Stromboli in one of their movies. So
yeah.
I guess it's pretty powerful.
And Marvel used to have a villain called Pie Face.
No, that was DC. He was Green Lantern's sidekick. Marvel has one word, Mandarin. Enough said on that, which I'm surprised he wasn't the villain in this movie, to be perfectly honest. So Tadashi, as part of acceptance, you have to create your thesis, basically, your project. And we're introduced to Baymax, who is a blow-up healthcare robot.
I am your personal healthcare companion.
Boy, the healthcare system definitely needs something like this. Could you imagine what fits they would throw if something like this came aboard?
Obamacare in 2013.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. You know what? I like this, though. I like the way we're seeing this. I like the way this character that we have here, it's not just an alien, quote-unquote. This character has a purpose. This thing has a purpose. It's about more than just being fluffy and making weird noises when it's deflating. Its purpose is to take care of you, is to be, like we mentioned, the healthcare part. I like the way there's a purpose to this other than them actually taking it and turning it into what it eventually becomes.
Well, as soon as I saw this in the marketing, my cynical brain was going on full force because I saw, oh, Disney's going to market the crap. But this is their new Olaf, you know, the mascot that they're going to shove down your throat. But Baymax is probably my favorite Disney character since the genie in Aladdin.
Wow.
And for one thing, I was shocked when I saw Alan Tudyk's name. I was shocked this was not him because I thought this would have been the role. But it's amazing how much they convey with just the body language. Like, this reminds me so much of Totoro. And I think it's really inspired. And it's also, some of the gags they do with him are funnier to me than they are to my kids. Especially one later on that, Garrett, you and I lived one of these moments in 2018, which I'll talk about shortly. But they took something that I rolled my eyes at and made me want to give him a nice big hug, which, yes, I'm capable of compassion, everybody. I know that's shocking.
That
to
is
hear.
Shocking.
Especially with a Disney movie, because I was pretty critical of a lot of, I didn't care for Frozen, I didn't care for Tangled. One of the directors of this did Bolt, which I forgot even existed.
I don't even know what that is.
John Travolta is the dog, which goes to show how outdated it was right away, because they cast John Travolta in a movie in 2008. Baymax is Tadashi's project, and eventually he'll be passed down to Hiro. We're also introduced to his teacher, who is Professor Callahan. And I knew that voice right away, James Cromwell.
Mm-hmm.
It'll do big.
Yeah, exactly. So I will say, I'm glad that they didn't go for a lot of celebrities, because I railed against Disney then for a long time. It's like they saw what happened with Robin Williams and just kept trying to duplicate that. I like how here, everyone, the voices are recognizable. Like, you can pull T.J. Miller out of a lineup. And I don't just say that because of his legal troubles. He could probably be picked out of a police lineup. But I think Cromwell was an inspired casting choice.
I agree with that. The casting here is very inspired. The problem when you cast somebody for their name is that you interpret it as being just the voice that it belongs to, not the voice that they are portraying. I think here, everybody here is cast for character purposes. It's a really, as you mentioned, diversified cast, but it also, I never think about the people who are portraying them.
Agreed, and I think there's been a big problem with that in a lot of animation, in a lot of video games, where if I'm watching a trailer for an animated something, and it's all about the names of these movie stars, I know the quality of the voiceover is going to be piss poor, because that's just not what they do. I think the people they got here do a great job, from Cromwell, who can do great voice work, but Jamie Chung is Go-Go. You know, that's somebody, she's done both sides of the aisle. Genesis Rodriguez, Alan Tudyk, obviously was like Disney's go-to guy for so much of this stuff, but I love that they're recognizable but I don't think of their faces when I'm hearing their mm-hmm. voices. It's crazy because I knew the voice of Tadashi, and it took me not until I rewatched it and started delving into it for this, but he's a star of one of my favorite TV shows going on right now, Wheel of Time. And I'm like, I know that voice. I know that voice. And I'm like, holy crap, a decade later, and I get to see him doing a TV show for a book series that I've loved for decades. It is a really big feat that Disney missteps a lot on with being able to cast properly for animation.
Yeah, which I think is, you want to get a voice with character, but you don't want, you want to be able to distinguish the character from the voice. As much as I love Wreck-It Ralph, I can't stand Sarah Silverman in those movies because all I hear is her voice.
That's my problem with Moana.
You have a rock bias.
Yeah, exactly.
God damn it. I love that movie. That movie literally made me cry in theaters, and I can't help but roll my eyes when I hear You're Welcome, even when I'm singing along.
It's like he was singing to you, and that's why you were so mad. And they got around this, like, Pixar cast Lewis Black, and it's perfect. So it can be done well. And you cast a kid who's actually age-appropriate for the person he's voicing, which not everybody has done. You know, you cast people in their 30s to voice teenagers. But Hiro unveils his project, which are nanobots that link together with a neural transmitter. So he's using the same technology that Cobra used in G.I. Joe.
Yes, he did.
Mixed with, he's got the inhibitor chip that Alfred Molina had in Spider-Man, where he could control them all. And the kid prodigy is accepted into the Institute of Technology, but celebrations cut short because a fire breaks out. The professor's caught in it. So it's a Marvel movie because it's a tragic death, because the brother runs in and he saves him, quote unquote, but he's killed in an explosion. So we're also back to the days where Disney was not afraid to kill off characters and not retcon it. Well, one of these they retcon, but the brother stays dead. There's no ambiguity about it.
That's what's great. Because the first time I watched this movie in theaters, I'm waiting for him to come back. Because he's like the only character wearing a hat. So I'm thinking that there's a tell that we're going to see later on. No, no, no. Tadashi is dead. Bravo. This is the most Spielbergian type of film. They kill him off quick.
Yeah, it's genuinely surprising.
Yeah. Disney not being afraid to... What? They killed Bambi's mom. Who else have they killed?
Mufasa.
Oh, yeah.
If we're talking off-screen versus on-screen, that'd be... I mean, they weren't afraid to kill their villains, and some of them die pretty horrifically.
The Gothel.
Tarzan's parents. That's pretty definitive.
Yeah. There's a lot. Well, yeah. We talked last week about a character that was killed that has little to no impact, and this is what wakes Hiro up, right? And this is also the character that sprung him forward to get to where he eventually goes. And yeah, this is a trope, but I was not expecting this, and neither was Hiro, obviously. And it's what turns him into what he eventually becomes, is this actual death. And that's when killing off characters can be very helpful to your story.
Well, I'm also very impressed that this movie is very, it's kid-oriented, but it doesn't talk down to kids.
No.
This is a very... I would say authentic depiction of grief and the five stages that come with it in a lot of ways. And I was very surprised at the approach they took.
Look, all of us have had people very close in our lives die, and this displays those stages of grief. You know what, Matt? I didn't think about it, but you're right. All of those are displayed here, and it does not talk down. And this would have been one of those movies where if I would have known it was like this, I wouldn't have been afraid to go by myself to see this amongst a bunch of kids. It does have that lasting impact on not only just a kid, but also an adult, and it prepares kids for what's eventually going to come in their lives, unfortunately.
This is when they do some of their best writing, is when they do it like this. Mm-hmm. Because so many movies, Tadashi would die, but it would be in the right before the third act. You have your final motivation to go do whatever the finale is going to be. That's not the way it's done here. It's done early because it matters, and it gives just so much impetus to the rest of the film.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we talk about in Star Wars, they kill off Ben Kenobi in the third act of that film.
Mm-hmm.
That's what propels Luke. This is done very early, and you're right. It's what gets him into the adventure that he eventually gets in and finds himself by the end.
Yeah, and they cut 2 weeks. They've had the funeral. He's cut himself off, as any teenager would. But he does the equivalent of stepping on a Lego, where he drops the block on his foot and that activates Baymax.
Yep.
So I thought the big reveal was going to be that Tadashi downloaded his consciousness into Baymax.
Ooh. No.
That's where my brain was going. I'm like, all right, this is how they're going to get around it. Thankfully, they don't do that. That would have been so schmaltzy that Bicentennial Man would have been like, hey, that's too much.
My God. example, the Bicentennial reference.
That is one of the most sacred movies you will ever see.
Yeah, definitely was.
Well, speaking of death, so Baymax is alive and well, and he tells him on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you rate your pain?
Oh.
Now, yeah. If I guess, that'd probably be about a 5. But if it was a Lego, it would have been an 8.
Yeah, this is tough because this thing is designed to help with health, right? And he is detecting that he is hurting, that Hero is hurting, and man, this is tough. This movie got to me, guys, much more than I was expecting.
It is smarter in that way, too, because it addresses mental health. It addresses loss, and nothing does that, especially an animated movie. I won't call this a kid's movie, but a family movie.
Mm-hmm.
To address pain and hurting, and I mean, just to have the balls to do it is fucking great.
Yeah, and not sugarcoat it.
Or talk down.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It's like when movies talk about religion, they have to lean on the side of optimism when it comes to if there's a life after this one. This one's very matter of fact. And with the exception of one thing, which we'll talk about, I think the writing is actually very sophisticated. And I think, like I said, it's certainly not what I was expecting when I walked in. I expected this to be a run-of-the-mill action movie with some cool characters and not much of a story. But like The Incredibles, this is much more of a more sophisticated superhero movie than the actual live-action superhero movies we were getting.
Definitely.
So Hero notices his one microbot that he kept starts to move on its own. So they go to this abandoned warehouse where they realize that the microbot is moving because they're being produced at an exponential rate by this guy wearing a kabuki mask, which made me think of No Time to Die, of all things, just because that's where my brain goes nowadays, or Kurosawa movies, for that matter. So Yoki is the big villain of the movie, quote-unquote. And look, Disney, we talked about this with Incredibles 2. This was the period where they were just doing twist villains all the time. And I feel like I called who the villain was just based on process of elimination.
Is it supposed to be a mystery, yeah, though?
Yes, because I use this all the time, but this is Scooby-Doo logic, where it's down to two suspects. And it's always the one that you don't suspect. Like, it's not a pup named Scooby-Doo where there's literally a character named Red Herring. It's the opposite. They're setting you up to think it's the Alan Tudyk character, only for it not to be.
Okay.
So I called this right away.
As opposed to the movie where Alan Tudyk does become the twist villain. God, I love the Wreck-It Ralph.
Yeah, that's the thing. I was like, that's one of the best ones they've done. Is the King Candy Turbo reveal.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking of The Incredibles. This character's No Syndrome. And I know that's a tough bar to jump over. He's the phase one Marvel villain of just, he's the guy in a cool outfit that the heroes have to fight.
They wrote him in a cave full of scraps.
That's actually one of the good ones. I love Jeff Bridges in that movie.
Yeah.
Oh, great. God, you got to be kidding me.
Oh, can't wait for him to come back.
So they realize that he's mass producing the microbots. And he tries to get rid of them, but they narrowly escape. And this is what I was talking about. This is what happens when your friend gets really drunk, your much larger friend compared to you, and you have to get them into your house without alerting other people. I lived this in 2018 with one of the people on these airwaves. I'm not going to get into the details, but if you want to hear more, be sure to join us next time in Chicago.
Yes. God damn.
But he's like deflating. He's like, we jumped out a window. This is clearly that bringing your drunk friend home after you've had one too many.
Or 10.
20 in your case. It was beers, shots, and gummy bears filled with alcohol. And it was the gummy bears that put it over the edge.
I agree.
Those things are dangerous.
Yeah, they were.
Speaking of danger, they realized that Yoki was the one who started the fire, but the fire is burning since the world's been turning.
Well played, sir.
So Hero decides, I gotta go after this guy because he probably killed my brother. And he goes into the anger portion where he weaponizes Baymax for the antithesis of what he was designed to be. He tries to turn him into a tubby Iron Man in a lot of ways. Not just because the color scheme is so similar.
Yeah, it's the suit-up sequence. You know, everything but have dummy in here.
Yeah. So Tadashi's friends, Baymax, like, reached out to them over his, like, network. So they all decide to team up to go fight the villain. He comes after them again. We get a cool chase scene in the streets. I will say the animation in this is really good.
I was about ready to say, no matter what I have to say in my summarization, this movie is beautiful. It's really gorgeous. It's really well animated. Disney has a set of standards, and 9 times out of 10, they live up to them. And these standards are way overboard. This animation is fantastic.
This kind of brought about the rebirth that I was really happy to see from Disney. Quick side note, I promise, really quick. There's a documentary called Waking Sleeping Beauty about with the Lion King and Little Mermaid and that, just really bringing back the quality that had dropped off at Disney and just bringing back that animation quality. This time frame between Princess and the Frog, Tangled, this, Frozen, this is when I felt like you just really woke back up the quality that I'd been missing at Disney for a long time. This thing is beautiful. It's storyboarded and then to animate it, just absolutely fantastic. I didn't think that they were capable of doing this type of stuff anymore. And I was glad that they could.
Well, I think they also knew we got to step our game up because the Avengers have happened and all this kind of stuff. So there was a certain expectation where just because it's animated doesn't mean it's an excuse for you to take shortcuts in your animation.
And really, I got to give credit to DreamWorks has helped propel and everybody raises their game. Because when they did things like How to Train Your Dragon and everybody went, oh, shit, it's not just Disney Pixar.
I'd also throw Kung Fu Panda, especially with the fight scenes.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because you can tell those people watched a bunch of Shaw Brothers movies and made them with a fat talking panda, which I can't believe those things go together as well as they do. Who knows? We'll talk about those someday.
Oh, no, we won't.
The Baymax saves the day yet again, and they go to Fred's house where he tells everyone that his dad's a superhero. Now, I did not know where this gag was going to go and that it was going to actually have a payoff, but it does, not for a little while. And the group gets their own upgrades, so this is where we really get the full, like, kind of like the Transformers and the Power Rangers getting their equipment in a lot of ways.
Yep.
You know what we got with this scene? We got a song that was required to be played in our vehicle anytime the family was going somewhere.
Really?
Oh my God. Immortals was the number one played song for, I gotta say, the next 18 months. My kids loved it.
Funny.
Yeah, it's funny because you didn't have to live that way.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I live vicariously through you guys.
I didn't have kids, but it was on the radio all the time.
I know, but you have kids now. And it's funny. Me and Jen always joke about what would our kids have been like. I just envision being in a car and being just required to play this. And then your head just spinning from, okay, this is too much. Oh, we want to play it again? Okay, we'll go ahead and play it again.
So they all get their equipment to go fight Yoki, and they think he is Alistair Cray, who is basically Norman Osborn, where he wanted to buy the microbots at the showcase, and they track him to, this is straight out of The Incredibles, a remote island where he's got a secret laboratory. Mm-hmm. And we're starting to get a little bit more of the breadcrumbs for what's going to be revealed, because they find out that the lab was used for teleportation, but the government shut it down because someone disappeared. And as soon as I heard the word teleportation...
I thought of you.
I called up in my seat because it's 2014, the mid-2000s. I knew what this was going to lead to in the third act, and sure enough, it does.
So, I'll say this is the most Marvel part of this Marvel movie.
It's the Mr. Freeze origin where the man came in and shut down the experiment, and it cost someone a loved one.
Yep.
The group are ambushed by Yoki again, but they do the unmasking here, and it's revealed to be Callahan, who faked his death by using the microbots to come up with a shield. Now, here's the problem with this reveal. Outside of the fact, I think it's kind of telegraphed. He feels like an entirely different character from this point on. I talk about character consistency a lot of times with these twist villains. I don't feel like this one works because his motivations make sense when that's discussed. That's independent of the opening. So why is this being conveyed now when this should have been addressed earlier?
I agree with you. I think from this point on, this movie kind of takes a turn. I'm not going to say for the worse because I'm never not having a good time, but the story-wise, it kind of falls. This is a falter. This should have been done better because you're right. The character consistency is inconsistent.
Yeah, not only that, but I think you have an issue when you start getting a little too cute for yourself, when you're writing problems just to keep problems in a movie. Look, I like Stargate. I think it's a pretty damn good movie. So I don't need, Stargate Lost. But you got to realize this is also a kid's family movie. And I think you're making it a little too convoluted for your own purposes. And these movies get rewritten many, many times over the 3 to 4 years it takes to animate them. So I just think they didn't clean it up nearly as well as they should have. It's not bad. But you just kind of go, not necessary.
One of the things that I think could have really separated this movie from typical superhero tropes is that you never find out who the villain is.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because that mask is so cool. Or you do like they did with the Hobgoblin in Spider-Man when he first debuted in the comics, where it's a long mystery of who it is. Like the mask keeps going to different people. Circumstances change. Like there's planted people. I feel like they could have made this a lot more interesting than it is. Or as it plays out, it's not great.
Well, I don't think keeping it hidden would have been much better. I just think you write it better. I think this reveal is a fault of the writing, not necessarily the fact that there's a villain. I don't mind the fact that there's a villain revealed. I just wish it was done in a more plausible way.
First time I'm watching this in theaters with the family, I'm waiting for it to be basically Harry Osborn Tadashi, where, you know, because he got injured, he's been brain damaged and he turned evil. That's what I'm waiting for. I'm glad they didn't go there, but I'm surprised because it seems a little too obvious.
Or they would have done the stupid thing of he's mind controlled with the nanobots.
Yep.
Now, Hero realizes that this guy's a scumbag and basically his brother gave his life for nothing. So he tries to eliminate Baymax's failsafe and get him to kill this guy, which certainly understandable motivations. And Baymax does it and goes full hit girl.
Yeah. I thought this was cool.
As someone who has never seen The Iron Giant, I've been told over and over that there seems to be a lot of homages to that film in here. And I was told that a lot of the way they use Baymax is done that same way.
Oh, I can definitely see that. And Hero is very similar to the main kid in that. Similar age, too. I think they're both like 14, 15. But they manage to reinsert the chip, so he calms down. And Hero says, screw you guys, I'm going home. but what I appreciate about this movie, like, there's never a moment where I'm not in some degree relating to this character or feel like he's acting out of character.
No. Especially at his age, what he's suffered, what he's gone through. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you called it out great that I didn't realize he's going through the steps of grief throughout this film.
Yeah, like now he's in full anger.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
So yeah, I think it's really well handled. He tries to take the chip out again, and Baymax says, "I'm sorry, Hal. I'm sorry. I'm afraid I can't."
And he locks the little port. Takes a page out of R2-D2's book and plays back the footage of Tadashi's goal to help others. And Hero should have pulled a Luke from Last Jedi and said that was a cheap move.
Let's not go back there.
All right. So I think this works really well. What does not work is they realize that the test pilot that went missing is Callahan's daughter. Now, this is totally just his part, but this should have been front-loaded in the movie like they tried to do in Incredibles 2 with the parents getting shot to try to explain the Screenslayer character. But as it is, I'm like, why are you doing this now?
Or like Incredibles 1, where you had, you know, you opened kind of at a different time of showing some stuff. If you would have opened this film, because it opens very quickly and bluntly, if you would have started this film showing this trans-dimensional, you know, transport, you could have then keyed back on it later. But this part, it seems really ham-fisted.
That's Dr. Mordred to you, sir.
Oh, I was going to say the spot. Should have called the spot. Callahan has gone full cartoon supervillain, where he reactivates the teleportation portal, which leads to a giant hole in the fucking sky.
Mm-hmm. Here you go.
Damn. I've seen Suicide Squad.
Let's see. And I got to break out my notes. Suicide Squad, The Avengers, Transformers, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, this.
Flaming portal in the sky.
Sky portal. Portal. More portal. Portal magic.
And this climax is really cool with, like, the way he's building, like, mental bridges and stuff with the nanobots. Yeah. All this stuff is really creative. But he gets beaten, and they're like, oh, wait, the movie still has a resolution we have to get to, so they have to rescue his daughter. And they do. I mean, this is right out of The Iron Giant. He might as well say Superman when he sacrifices himself.
I thought of that.
This looks so beautiful. And on the big screen, the colors, the brightness, this looked, oh, God, it is one of their most beautiful films.
They enter the portal, and Abigail's in stasis. Baymax gets hit by some kind of debris. So Hero has no choice but to leave him behind, and he uses his Falcon Punch to propel them out of the portal. She gets taken to the hospital. The dad gets arrested. So they break the Disney trope, though, of not killing off the villain, which they sort of made a name for.
Mm-hmm.
And even Marvel got away from that. I mean, it took them killing off all of their great villains for them to stop doing that.
Yeah, we got to stop doing one and dones. Yeah.
Someone should have said as soon as Sam Raimi killed off the Green Goblin, we should be like, maybe we should stop doing this so early. That goes all the way back to 89.
Yeah. Yep. Well, Secret Wars is going to bring every single one back.
So a little bit of time has passed. Hero was at the Institute, and he finds the healthcare. I feel like I should say Barack Obama's name every time I say healthcare chip.
inside the fist, and he's able to rebuild Baymax, and they actually form the Big Hero 6 team, as we come to know. So the team actually comes back together. A little schmaltzy with and contrived with him rebuilding Baymax. I feel like that's the one time, please don't laugh when I say this, they literally pull their punches.
Boy, you're on a roll on this one, Matt. Yeah, but you know what? I like this, though. I'm a sucker for this kind of stuff.
From the first time I heard the Tadashi is here, it's hard not to well up. Mm-hmm. You know, especially if you've suffered loss. If you've ever just wanted that one more moment, goddamn, I'm tearing up just thinking about it. They do it so well. And I think that dispassionate voice just kind of leads you into you bringing what you want to it or what you need from it.
Yeah. And again, it's the fact that I'm not envisioning who's doing this voice. I don't know who does it.
Exactly.
But I feel this character deep. And I'm not going to say it got me so deep that it made me well up, but I definitely got more out of this movie than I was expecting on a deep level.
And the movie's not over because it can't be a Marvel movie without a post-credit scene.
And I got to say, before you get this, did you get this, Matt, I'm sure you have. Garrett, did you get this drop earlier in the film?
No, I did not.
Okay, because they pass by a family painting of a cameo earlier in the film. And I thought that was the only cameo we were going to get.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I thought that was going to be it.
Which I was okay with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But nope, Fred finds a secret lair in his house, and his dad is also a superhero, voiced by Stan Lee, which I should accuse of being too much inside baseball, but look, by the time we get to 2014, the cameos were just obligatory, and a lot of them were kind of groan-inducing, where it's like, oh, that's just a cheap way to put him in the movie. Like, they started out being really clever, like, he didn't speak, you know, in the first X-Men movie, he's just on the beach.
Yeah, we'll talk about that when we get to Marvel proper. They definitely got way overboard. When he's in a truck trying to pull out Thor's hammer, I was like, God damn, what the fuck are you doing to this guy? But here, the fact that I wasn't expecting a Stan Lee cameo in this, even though it was a Marvel movie, per se, I felt this as well.
I also like that that it's him animated. I almost feel like this is animated. I almost want to put him side by side from Into the Spider-Verse. I like seeing him writ this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or Teen Titans Go to the Movies.
Yeah.
All of his best ones are animated.
True.
The one I actually like, it's we'll talk about this in a couple of years, I like his one in Daredevil.
Yes.
I'm like, okay, that's actually pretty clever how they use it. But speaking of cleverness, that does it on Big Hero 6. So, surprised we had an energetic discussion, but we're doing this after recording another show. So, on a scale of 1 to 10, Garrett, what do you give Big Hero 6?
Look, Big Hero 6 is not a movie I would go out of my way to see. In fact, if it wasn't for this podcast, I probably would have never revisited it. It was a movie I watched and just kind of flew over me, and I was done with it because I had hit my consistency of seeing every Marvel film, which, as you guys know, I am a stickler for completionism. But Matt, you assigned this to us, and I had to watch it again. And sometimes that can be a chore. Sometimes, for example, about a month ago when we did Howard the Duck, I struggled to get through that. Last week, Kick-Ass 2, I struggled to get through that. And let's not even talk about the second and third week of this particular podcast. For the most part, with the exception of the first Kick-Ass, this series has been kind of rough. But revisiting Big Hero 6 is an exact reason why I love doing this podcast, because it lets me rediscover things that I had missed before. And the fact that I knew that it was a Marvel film at this point, and as I was watching this, I felt every emotion that these characters were going through. I really, really liked this viewing. I had a pretty good time with it. I think the fact that Betamax was kind of a double for E.T. made me really love it, because as people know, that is probably in my top three favorite movies of all time. Big Hero 6 was a joy to go through. I think the voice acting is great because I don't think of the voice actors. I think the action scenes are very good. I think the animation is fucking gorgeous. And anybody who watches this, you can't take your eyes off it. Even 10 years later, I watch it. Sometimes you watch animated films and the animation, Matt, we discussed this when we discussed Toy Story, doesn't really hold up. But I think here it really holds up. And this movie is an emotional journey. You're not going to get a prototypical fun Disney film when you watch this, yet there is still fun to be had. So I think it walks that line very well. It's not a great film, but it's a very, very good film. I really enjoyed going through this. So I want to go ahead and give a 7.5 to Big Hero 6.
The dreaded 0.5.
Yep.
Finally did it. Well, Adam, what say you?
Big Hero 6. This is one of those where I wish Marvel would take a look at what worked in this film and bring it into theirs a little more. Because this film really does work from start to finish with a little bit of road bumps here and there. First of all, the casting does such an amazing job throughout. You're not distracted by who they are because they're giving really great performances. This is a Spielberg Marvel movie. I appreciate that they actually have the stones to kill somebody off early, leave them dead. And it's a fact of the movie, not just a motivating factor. Baymax is a delight throughout this film. Does this house of mine have a stuffed Baymax in it? You're damn right it does. We got a big posable Baymax. And do you know how many times throughout these last 10 years we're holding a cat and all four of us in this house are saying, furry baby, furry baby? I mean, a decade later, we're still quoting this film in my house, and we haven't watched it regularly in a very long time because my kids have started to grow up. But it's so fun to go back to. It's enjoyable to go back to. The little things that they hit in this film, like when Go-Go, when she's typing out stuff on her purse to get these little elemental balls, she's got the periodic table on her purse, and it's actual makeup of periodic elements that she's doing. Little stuff like that from the animators really help this film be better than just your run-of-the-mill Disney that we were getting in the early 10s. And it kind of pushes it into that level that we got with Frozen, with Tangled, which is beautiful. This is such a delight. The third act goes into the Marvel territory. You get big swirling vortex of stuff in the sky. And I love that later movies have finally started to call out that trope. But this is one, you could watch it with the family, and I think you'll get a lot out of it. You could watch it with yourself, and you'll enjoy it. Soundtrack is good. The animation is brilliant. And I'm glad it exists. It's a little sad they never followed up a movie with it. The TV series did fine. With them spending the money to literally redesignate an area of the theme park, I don't think they're done with Big Hero 6. But, man, I really like this film. I'm going to give it a 7. I know that sounds like it's bad, but it's not. It's a really good film. I appreciate it. I'm so happy it exists. I love that I got a Baymax here in the house, because this movie, it hits on a lot of elements and a lot of levels. It has no reason to be as good as it is, but fuck, it's good. So 7 on 10 for Big Hero 6.
And I'll go ahead and up at a half point. I'll give it an 8 just on the emotional level of it.
Well, call me surprised, because I didn't think Garrett had a soul. Really dreading this review, because this seemed like the kind of movie he would be that guy and say, I thought it was fine, but I didn't get anything out of it. And that was kind of my perspective going into the theater. And I was glad to be proven wrong, because it does happen from time to time. I think I underestimated Disney's ability to still tug at my heartstrings, and they kind of did. Not perfect, certainly. There are some... For a movie that has really sophisticated writing, I do have to knock it for the villain stuff not being as good as everything else. Because I think a strong supervillain oftentimes takes a good superhero movie into a great one. Some of the best ever have the iconic villains. Because if The Dark Knight did not have the Joker in it, I don't know if that movie would be as celebrated as it is. Maybe if you swap someone else in, but we'll see. Only time will tell. I was really impressed. The animation's top-notch. I really got a lot out of the, like I said, the five stages of grief. I can't believe I saw that in a Disney movie, although they've handled delicate subject matter before, but I wasn't expecting it in this package, especially with something that was marketed as a boy and his robot. So the heroics are very well done for animation. I mean, you get your money's worth. They didn't phone this in. This wasn't a Cars 2 situation, among other things, but I don't think it's perfect. But as it is, it's certainly worth watching. I don't like using the word underrated for a movie that made almost $700 million, but I think this deserves another look if you haven't seen it in a while, because I feel like I got more out of it now than I did when I first saw it. So I'll give it a very strong 7, but don't take that as a slight whatsoever. So on a scale of 1 to 10, I rate this a 7. So,
well,
I think it's nice to see us all go, this movie is so much more than people give it credit for.
And this series has been way too agreeable. I mean, we agreed on all of our scores with the two Kick-Ass films, and now we're doing this. Come on, guys. We got to start fighting sometime here.
Well, if there was a movie,
I guarantee it, it's coming.
Well, if there was a movie to fight about, it would be a spy movie, because we had some wars over 007 himself. And now we're talking about a movie that really is, in a lot of ways, a throwback to James Bond in a totally different package with Kingsman, the Secret Service. Back to Matthew Vaughn. We're back to Mark Millar. I was so excited to go see this. I had not read the comic, but spy movies tickle my Walther PPK. And this, I thought the trailer for this, I was like, wait, Colin Firth is going to be a fucking, as James Bond? What is this? And then they show that clip of him in the pub in the trailer, and I'm like, all right, I'm sold. So I was really excited to go see this. I thought the trailers were really inventive. Matthew Vaughn was back. Look, the man has wanted to make a James Bond movie his whole life. That's why there's so much Bond in First Class. So this seemed like his, everything was aligning. My only question mark was, I didn't know who the fuck Taron Egerton was. And if he could carry a movie. So I was excited, and I can't believe I'm saying that about a Mark Millar movie, but Garrett, did you match my sentiment whatsoever?
I had zero desire to see this.
Really?
Yeah. This was coming out. It felt too much of a wink to the audience, and people know I don't like that. It felt like it was something that was just trying to take off what Matthew Vaughn really wanted to do, which was a Bond film. And when movies are made with that kind of strife, and again, this is yet another one. I didn't even know it was a comic until it was out. But yet, when I saw it initially, I will say it surprised the hell out of me, and I will say whether that is a positive or negative thing till next week, but I had zero desire to see this. It was only because of word of mouth, probably from you and some of the people that we used to work with, that made me finally get off my ass and actually see it.
Adam, same, or were you more in my boat?
So I was like, ooh, who's doing this? Matthew, okay, I liked when he did X and this. And then I saw the trailer and I went, nope, I got no desire to see this film. I saw that first trailer and I went, it looks so Britishy to me, it put me off.
You gave one of the Bond films fucking eights. What are you talking about? You love fucking Britishy stuff, if that's even a word.
I would not call those British, though. That's the thing about them. This feels like I needed bad teeth to walk into a movie theater. I mean, it just...
I thought we left the racism in Kick-Ass too.
I can't believe you just said that.
I hope Nate doesn't hear this.
I'm watching a lot of White Lotus this week, okay?
Okay, yeah, that makes sense then.
It's just, I don't know, something about the trailers really put me off. So I didn't watch it until it came to video, I think is when I got it. Might have been DVD. I think I Redboxed it, actually, when it came out. So I'll give my thoughts based on that. But initially, no desire. Since then, we'll discuss it.
I saw it three times in the theater. Because I wanted my spy fix. I was getting a Bond movie later that year, and I was so excited for Spectre, only to be kicked in the nuts when it actually came out. So it was like, okay, this will hold me over until Spectre and Mission Impossible come out later this year. We got Man from U.N.C.L.E. that year, too. So 2015 was the year of the spy movie, apparently.
Well, that was the same year. God, yeah. That's underrated. Man from U.N.C.L.E., God, that's so much fun.
I mean, look, this movie spawned a sequel. It spawned a prequel.
Mm-hmm.
But did it warrant what hell hath it wrought? We'll find out next week. So until next week, when we discuss Kingsman the Secret Service and break out our dentures and bad accents based on what Adam was pitching, we jumped out of podcast. Thank you, guys.
La 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 la. I'm gonna be risky.
I know what you're gonna say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just gonna tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts. Ooh, I'm living dangerous. What you did, I'll make you pay for it. See, I know that you're scared.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise, the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise, Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Exit. Words to live by.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men and a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Time's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
You really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Shows over, motherfuckers.
Okay, Adam, you ready?
Adam? Sorry, I had to get the door to delivery.
Why do your deliveries always come during our recordings? How many fucking deliveries do you have a week?
One, okay, I'm married.
That's true.
Two, I have a child who now has her own card that's linked to our stuff, so it's amazing that she knows how well Amazon works. But also, they just had a bunch of Ted Lasso products on sale from the WB store, so I needed some Richmond hats and gear.
I like how you had the preload to that, but yet, it was all about you.
You should have just led with that.
I know!
Ba-la-la-la.
He's involved in the dangerous world of illegal robot fighting. So it's basically Rock'em Sock'em Robots mixed with Fight Club.
Yeah, 3 years before this, there was the... God damn it. What was the name?
Real Steel?
Yes.
Real Steel?
There was Real Steel.
Ba-la-la-la.
So I thought the big reveal was going to be that Tadashi downloaded his consciousness into Baymax.
Ooh. No.
That's where my brain was going. I'm like, all right, this is how they're going to get around it. Thankfully, they don't do that. That would have been so schmaltzy that Bicentennial Man would have been like, hey, that's too much.
My God. Pull the Bicentennial reference.
That is one of the most sacred movies you will ever see.
Yeah, definitely was. I just watched that for the first time like 5 years ago, and I was shocked at how sacred it was.
Yeah, like the first half is pretty good, and then the second half, when he's actually like full-blown Robin Williams, it goes down the crack. The line of demarcation is when they kill off Sam Neill. Well, speaking of death, so...
Ba-la-la-la.
On a scale of 1 to 10, Garrett, what do you give Big Hero 6?
I hate when you go to me first, which is probably why you do it.
I went to Adam first last time.
I know, you bastard.
Ba-la-la-la.
So, until next week when we discuss Kingsman the Secret Service and break out our dentures and bad accents based on what Adam was pitching, we jumped out of podcast. Thank you, guys.
La-la-la-la.
Did we lose Garrett?
Did we lose Garrett at the very end? God damn. You know, at least we got through it.
99% of the way, and he tripped at the finish line.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
There it is. Okay, I got it.
Thank God.
God damn. I'm sorry. Repeat the last few minutes. What'd you say? Or at least summarize it.
Where do you want me to start?
Did you already sign off?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just you already signed off. Then we're good. All right.
Yep.
Okay. Good. He jumped down because we have it so that we have our mattresses like right against the wall, and my computer is right on the table against the mattresses. So he'll jump on the mattresses and lay on it for a while, and then when he jumps off, he'll walk right over the computer, which is what he just did. Okay. Next week.